Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
A note before we begin this episode. This week, we're talking about complications relating to pregnancy and childbirth, which means we'll be discussing miscarriage, preterm labor, and the sometimes heartbreaking statistics for pregnant people and babies in the United States. This is a topic that both Maya and I care deeply about. We also know it's a challenging conversation for some people. So please take care while listening and seek help if you need it.
You're listening to Well Now, Slate's podcast on health and wellness. I'm Maya Feller.
And I'm Kavita Patel. For many, pregnancy is a time of so many emotions, heightened, joyful anticipation, lots of doctor's appointments, tests, preparation, all with a focus on bringing home a healthy baby. The other side of pregnancy, the complications, the things that are messy, are not readily discussed. Despite being one of the richest nations in the world, the United States has the highest levels of maternal and infant mortality amongst developed nations.
In 2022, the CDC counted more than 22 maternal deaths per 100,000 live births. That's more than 10 times the estimated rate for other rich countries like Australia, Japan, and Spain. The statistics get even worse for Black women. With that same CDC data showing we suffered 50 deaths out of 100,000 live births. That was more than double the rate of maternal deaths for white women. Black babies are also dying at alarming rates. They're more than twice as likely to die in childbirth than white babies.
Then there are the myriad of other issues that could arise during pregnancy. As many as half of pregnant people experience complications such as diabetes, hypertension, or elevated blood pressure, infections, and unfortunately much more. And while this information is not new, it continues to impact lives, scores of lives. Maya, you have a very personal story to share with listeners that ties into all of this. Please tell us your story.
So, Kavita, my story dates back to 2016, and sadly, I really have to say that not much has changed with regard to the statistics. My first child, Torin Simeon Feller, died a day after he was born. Prior to my pregnancy, I did my homework. I really looked for a provider that was specialized in fibroids because I have fibroids. I attended every single appointment. I was on time. I had my notebook. I had my questions. I researched, and let me tell you, I researched well. I wanted to know everything that I needed to have a successful pregnancy, and I was very attentive. 23 weeks into the pregnancy, I began to experience significant pain, and I immediately scheduled an appointment. I was seen the next day, and my doctor told me that the large fibroid that I had was degenerating. Now, this was not a shock or surprise. We expected this to happen at some point during the pregnancy. I was then sent home with ibuprofen. Within 24 hours, I went into preterm labor and delivery. Kavita, I walked out of a local public hospital empty-handed. Within a 48-hour window, I went from being this happy, expectant mother to a statistic. Perhaps, you know, my pain had been discounted. Perhaps it was my age that produced bias about me. Or maybe it was like something about my race, about what I could quote unquote handle as a strong Black woman. Maybe all of that made it really easy for my provider to turn away from the bigger picture. I mean, I now know actually that the standard of care for people with fibroids is that you're supposed to be admitted and watched. That was not the case for me. I did end up staying with my gynecologist for the second and third pregnancies. They were high risk. I also saw, in addition to my gynecologist, a high risk specialist, and we had additional genetic testing done. Of course, with the second and third pregnancies, I was on progesterone because maybe we were trying to figure out how to keep me pregnant longer and, you know, pregnant to term so that I could deliver. There were so many more interventions. I now have two wonderful children that I'm incredibly grateful for each day. And the thing that really gets me, Kavita, is that I feel like the diligent care that I got in those subsequent pregnancies were the result of an adverse outcome. And none of it was my fault because I followed the playbook. And it should be the benchmark for every patient that that happens at the start of their care.
Maya, I wish, you know, look, I'm sure that everybody's going to say how sorry they are, and we are, but I'm more angry than anything because I can't imagine the loss or the devastation. But as you're speaking, I've heard this story. Obviously, I know you, you're a friend, but every single time I hear it, I get angry and I get more angry. And then I start to think, like, how many other women, you know, or people are just listening, and could my loss have been prevented? Or could something that has happened, could that very same care have been different? Too many people can relate to this feeling, to this loss, unfortunately. So I want to thank you for sharing that. I know that it's never easy. And I think you and I have talked about grief. Like, I've spent my career as a physician kind of unintentionally, intentionally studying grief. And it's like this rock in your shoe. Like, it's always there. Sometimes if you're running a certain way or walking a certain way, you feel it really acutely and you can kind of sense it. And then many times it's just there and it's present, but it doesn't hurt you in that moment. And I know that others can relate to that. And I certainly can relate to that. When you think about the grieving process, and I know that this extends so far beyond you and your family and how they navigated it, can you talk a little bit about that, kind of coming home empty-handed and what it looked like now that you have two beautiful children whom I know it all seems like it's in the past, but I know for you it's ever present. What did it look like kind of afterwards? And any words of advice for our listeners who are in that moment right now?
Yeah, Kavita. So I came home, and because there was no baby, it was really clear for all my friends and neighbors that something had gone awry. And because I was so far into my pregnancy, there was no cover for me. And so it was every time I saw someone kind of rehashing the story. One of the things that we did within my family to grieve was that we decided that we were going to have a proper funeral and that we were not going to just push this under the rug. And so we brought everyone together and had a really beautiful, meaningful service that was healing. It was the beginning of healing. And then I very quickly went into therapy. And I went in to begin to do the work of navigating what happened to me and then recounting the details so that I could write it down and document it for later, which I think is something that's really important for people if they have an experience like this, is to really write down what your experience was, because you're going to forget, right? I don't remember everything now, but because I've written it down and I've got detailed notebooks, I have like more of a clear idea of what really happened. And then just like you said, Kavita, the other part was that I gave myself so much grace, and I actually really checked out of life for 3 years. I was in graduate school at the time. I stopped and I said, I need a break. And I did not judge that I needed that. And I took it and I went to therapy and I went running and I walked a lot. And then we started trying 3 months later. We got the clear, and I knew for myself with the work that I had done in that little period of time that I was going to be petrified going into the next pregnancy, that if I waited too long, the likelihood that I would never try again was incredibly high. So for me, I made the choice within that year to try again. And everyone has to think about it differently and they have to do what works for them. But I would say the big takeaway was being open and honest about the experience with my close friends and the people in my circle, taking the time to begin the initial work of grieving and knowing that the process would be ongoing, because of course I think about it every day on his birthday, and then also working with my healthcare provider to come up with a plan for what was going to happen next. Kavita, in your work as a physician, how have you navigated these spaces with your patients?
Yeah, I'll talk about that. Thank you for asking, and I had told you when we were going to talk about this episode, I didn't want to talk about my own losses. I've had them. I'm still a little, it's very hard for me to speak about them. That's why I'm grateful that our guest that we're going to have on today has not just written a book, but kind of provided a community to support these discussions. So the way I help patients navigate it is by kind of living a life through it with them. And I'll be honest with you, especially because I treat people in a community setting where the majority of my patients are Black and brown women, I often, even if they're not thinking about getting pregnant, I often do the like, here's what happens when you walk in and you're a person of color and you're pregnant or you're seeking help. I coach them on what to say. And it's not that I'm telling them to make things up, but I know that a woman with uterine fibroids or pelvic pain, if she's a Black woman, I know statistically she's much less likely to receive some of the care that now is considered kind of a benchmark standard of care and practice. And then I know if you're a pregnant woman and you don't seek and ask questions, and I tell them, and I'm an internal medicine doctor, so I do not deliver babies. I don't deal with pregnancy, but I do end up having patients who are mine that become pregnant. And I also help them think about how to find the right doctors. You probably all know this, listeners know this, that when you're delivering, you kind of deliver with a practice. Yes, you might have your OB, but because we can't exactly predict when we're delivering our babies, you might have one of their partners on call. And I've encouraged people to kind of rotate during their kind of course of early pregnancy to meet the other partners and to look them in the eyes and say very clearly, like, I want to do everything to understand like what might go wrong, or without sounding paranoid. And I tell them, like, have a checklist. I'm a very, you know, kind of checklist oriented person. So I try to give them, like, here are some minimum standards, some things you need to ask about. But even with all that, Maya, it's what you said, the statistics are going in the wrong direction. And we're not able to necessarily kind of do everything we need to do. I even recommend to people about kind of which hospitals I know have crash carts that are prepared to deal with kind of postpartum hemorrhage and some of the complications. I also tell women, like, do not wait for that 6-week appointment. Kind of if you think things are not going right, like, here's what we can do. And, you know, reach out to me, even though I'm not the OB, I'll help make sure you get in to be seen, because we know too many people also die in the days following birth. And so this is, I think, it's an important episode. And I want to just say that that's why we wanted to talk to somebody who has not only looked at the pregnancy landscape, but really thought about this from a data-driven approach. I'm a personal consumer of her output and very excited to talk about this with Emily Oster to help us understand navigating complications during, after pregnancy, and just honestly kind of birth and data around that. So stay tuned. Well, now, listeners, if you're enjoying the show and want to hear more, subscribe to our feed. New episodes come out every Wednesday morning. While you're there, check out our other episodes too, like last week's about large and unexpected healthcare bills with previous Surgeon General Jerome Adams. Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
Americans take about 20,000 breaths a day and spend an average of 90% of their time indoors. The indoor air we breathe can be up to 100 times more polluted than outdoor air, according to the EPA. Indoor air pollutants can cause respiratory symptoms like sneezing, congestion, scratchy throat, and even more serious health problems like lung and heart disease. So what's the solution? Introducing Air Doctor, the air purifier that filters out 99.99% of dangerous contaminants so your lungs don't have to. This includes allergens, pollen, pet dander, dust mites, mold spores, and even bacteria and viruses. Air Doctor comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund minus shipping. Head to airdoctorpro.com and use the promo code WELLNOW, and you'll receive up to $300 off air purifiers. Exclusive to podcast customers, you'll also receive a free 3-year warranty on any unit, which is an additional $84 value. Lock in this special offer by going to airdoctorpro.com and use promo code WELLNOW. Welcome back. You're listening to Well Now. I'm Maya Feller.
And I'm Kavita Patel. Today we are talking about pregnancy, specifically complications. Emily Oster is an economist and a professor of economics at Brown University. Her new book is called The Unexpected, Navigating Pregnancy During and After Complications. Emily, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad to be here and having this conversation with you.
So, Emily, something that we do and just give us a little bit of latitude here, because we like to ask everybody, our show is called Well Now. So we do like to start by asking everyone how they define wellness. And I want you to offer us, in the context of everything you've been learning and teaching, how do you think about wellness?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I think if someone asked me, you know, what should I do to enhance wellness? In some sense, what I would say is you think about what's important to you and prioritize the things that you want to be doing. For me, that's a much more important component of like deep wellness than another answer I'm tempted to give, which is like my own personal approach, which is just more miles. If you run more miles, that's how you define wellness. I don't think I would give that advice to people. I think it's much more about finding a place where you're happy with how your day is, and then you can make good choices on top of that because you're content.
And Emily, both can be true, because the more miles, that resonates.
Yeah, for me, that's it.
More miles.
You and I, Maya, more miles.
more miles.
I love it.
So in your most recent book that I devoured, Kavita and I, we devoured it, you give this roadmap for pregnant people to help them really navigate the unexpected. Can you tell us about how you conceptualize that particular framework?
So this book is written together with Dr. Nate Fox, who's a maternal fetal medicine specialist. And when Nate and I came to think about how we wanted the book to read, we wanted people to be able to come into this and get a part at the top where they can, the sort of first part of the book is a general sense of, you know, how to encounter the medical system with any complicated question. But then when people have had one of these complications, we wanted to dig in and answer really the three questions that we saw across our two areas of expertise. So what is the risk that this will happen again? What are the treatment options that might affect my risk? And then how do I talk to my doctor about it? And so when we structure the book, we structure these chapters, there's me on the parts I do, which is what does the data say about recurrence? What does the data say about treatment? Let me dive in. And then there's Nate on, you know, what's the way to make this conversation with your doctor work for you and for them? And those three pieces all strike me as very important in getting to the best possible outcome in this often very hard situation.
And your approach, so Emily, what I love is the data-driven approach, your Substack, which I've now subscribed, Parent Data. And so you do have, obviously, in the name, data is very important. Your training as an economist plays into this. Can you tell us why the data has been so important? Describe to us the role that data plays in understanding pregnancy, and especially in what your most recent book with Dr. Fox is about.
So my whole life is organized around my love of data, more or less. And when I got pregnant, you know, now many, many years ago, for the first time, I wanted to engage with that pregnancy with more data than I found to be available in the way that I was communicated with during the pregnancy in the books that were available. So the first book, Expecting Better, was really my dive into the data around the questions I had about pregnancy, some of which were like, what does the data say about sushi? But then some of which were, you know, what does the data say about bed rest? What does the data say about epidurals? And that idea of using data to make decisions about your health has been a constant through all of the books. In this book, it's there too. So it's the answer to the question, you know, what's the risk of recurrence of something? It's what does the data say about treatment? And then it's an input to many of these decisions. And I think part of what's maybe a little bit different about this setting than, you know, a decade ago when I was writing about more standard pregnancy questions is that in many of these settings, it's the combination of the data and your personal values and, you know, exactly what happened to you. So a lot of what we're thinking about here is how do you bring together what we know from the evidence, from the data into your particular situation and thinking about which of the pieces of the data are most relevant for you, given the details. So it's a bringing together of the very detailed medical stuff with broader pictures out of the larger scale data.
And so when we're looking at those, I'd say variables, right? So the data itself, the individual, and then kind of the risk. How did you conceptualize using the data to inform the treatment during pregnancy, as well as how people can be prepared for subsequent pregnancies? Because when I was reading it, I was so struck, it was crystal clear. And I was like, my goodness, had I had this book, I could actually have walked in and like put it down on the table and said, read this right here. This is backing me up 100%. So like, but tell us more about that, how you got to that point.
So for the data questions, kind of two things where the data can be very informative. So one is this question about recurrence risk, which I think is a place that people often come in, like, is this going to happen again? And even if we take something like first trimester miscarriage, which is one of the most common complications we talk about in the book, about something like a quarter of pregnancies will end in miscarriage. When you look at the data there, one thing that comes out very clearly that should inform treatment is that the elevated risk of another miscarriage after you have one is not very much. So a lot of people have one miscarriage. Unfortunately, it's very, very common. And the chance of having another one is it's a little bit higher, but it's not very much higher. And so after one miscarriage, the advice of try again, we probably don't need to do any additional testing, makes sense for that reason for most women. After two miscarriages, the chance of another one goes up a lot. And that's not to say that we understand exactly why that is, but it suggests there's something more that could be going on. And that's a point at which coming in and saying, hey, we should try to figure out, is there something more going on than just bad luck? It may just be bad luck. I mean, 90% of miscarriages in the first trimester are for chromosomal abnormalities. So it may just be two unfortunate circumstances, but there also are some things that can happen that could be more systematic, some of which may be treatable. So that's a place where you look at the data and then you want to say, I need to take this and say, listen, now I'm in this category. Like I want to talk about, here are some things that could be going on. Let's actually try to test for those. So for me, that kind of thing, that sort of diving into like, what do we know about the recurrence risk and what does that say about where I should be and what kind of treatment I should be pursuing? That feels like the really crucial step in all of these conversations.
That makes so much sense to me, right? So taking the evidence and then being able to use the data, and it's so grounding and strong because then you have an idea of what the possibilities are for yourself.
Yeah. And I think the other thing about some of these pieces of data is that it brings people to a place where they can have a more productive conversation with their doctor, where they can say, look, here's what I understand. This is what happened to me, but I now know I'm at some elevated risk. Can we talk about doing that moving forward? And I think often these conversations with providers don't go exactly the way we hope because we're not coming in with quite enough information to engage with the expertise that is coming from our provider.
So Kavita mentioned your Substack, and you said, Emily, that there were so many questions and kind of that came from people. Is there one that, you know, one of those personal stories that really stands out to you and is like maybe something that made you want to go and re-examine, take another look at the data?
I'll tell you the story, one of the two stories that I tell at the end of the book. There was someone who wrote to me now a number of years ago when she lost her son at 27 or so weeks. And she had a lot of questions at the time about both navigating that experience physically and then about recovering from it. And we stayed in touch. And then maybe 2 years later, she sent me a baby picture of her son. He shared the middle name with his brother. And having been there for that and helped in some way, whatever way I could, the goal of being able to do that a little more broadly, that is why I wrote the book.
We're going to take a break here. When we come back, we'll hear more from Emily Oster on the preparations needed to navigate pregnancy complications. Elevate your summer getaway with Cozy Earth's luxurious bedding and loungewear. I just recently got back from a trip to Chicago, and I had the ultimate pleasure of wearing Cozy Earth's bamboo joggers. Oh my goodness, they were temperature regulating and so comfortable to wear. I felt cool. I never got overheated on the airplane. They're incredibly soft, and I looked great too. I felt really like a fashion-forward traveler who was eco-friendly at the same time. So whether you're exploring distant lands or enjoying a staycation at home, Cozy Earth has your back. Visit CozyEarth.com and unlock an exclusive 35% off with code WELLNOW. It's time to prioritize your well-being without sacrificing adventure. Let Cozy Earth be your trusted companion on the path to health, fitness, and unforgettable experiences.
I started using Peloton about 5 years ago with the original bike. I needed something that would offer some structure of a class and flexibility to get on the bike or just move whenever I had time. And I was honestly struggling to figure out a way to get to the gym, take a shower after the gym. So the Peloton bike for me came at the perfect time. And what I realized is that even if you only had 5 minutes, there was some sort of Peloton programming for you. But I would highly encourage you to think about using all the classes, even if you don't have the equipment, because they have a range of meditation programming, yoga. I've even recommended some of the meditation classes to patients and colleagues with insomnia. It can be the perfect way to help you unwind after an incredibly busy and stressful day. And they just take all the complexity out of planning and make it so much easier to click and go and feel like you've actually accomplished something, even in a short amount of time. So get a head start on the summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com. This episode is brought to you by Fail Better, David Duchovny's new podcast with Lemonada Media. On Fail Better, David, who has experienced both low and high profile failures throughout his life, explores the vast world of failure, how it holds us back, propels us forward, and ultimately shapes our lives. Each week, he will chat with guests like Ben Stiller, Bette Midler, and more about how our perceived failures have actually been our biggest catalyst for growth, revelation, and even healing. Through these conversations, he hopes listeners can learn how to embrace the opportunity of failure and fail better together. Fail Better is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Well Now from Slate. I'm Maya Feller.
And I'm Kavita Patel. We're continuing our conversation with Emily Oster, who has written an incredible book and is also the author of one of my favorite newsletters in general called Parent Data. Emily, all right, let's get into some specifics about your book. In chapter 2 of your most recent book, The Unexpected, you wrote, and we're going to quote here, "We have the tendency to downplay our experiences. The pain, the nausea, the discomfort was not that bad. But you'll be better positioned for success if you can open up about your experiences and how they felt for you. I think there's just so many people who are listening who are like, yes, 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 triple bold, underline, highlight, all the things. Because I even remember telling my kind of labor and delivery nurse for my first child, I remember saying, because she was like on a scale, you know, the scale, 1 to 10. And I was like, oh, no, I can handle pain. I even remember saying, I'm a doctor. I can handle pain. And it was almost like a source of pride that was just so messed up and bizarre. But tell us more about just kind of what went in behind that line. I happen to know that you've also afforded many of your kind of readers, subscribers, a community. So I know there's some of these incredible stories that kind of inform a lot of this. Tell us more.
Yeah. And the book in general is really informed by reader questions and the things that have come back from my readers in the past decade. But this idea that we're going to downplay what happened is so common and also so problematic for getting the care that we need. I mean, nausea is like one example. People write to me, they'll be like, I don't know if I should go in. I'm only vomiting 23 times every day. And yesterday I was able to have 3 sips of water. So I, like, it's really not so bad. It's like you need treatment for that. And there are things we can do. There are treatments that might be able to work, but there's such a both sort of, I think, almost individual pressure of like, well, I should be able to, you know, I should be able to power through this. Like you said, Kavita, like, you know, well, I'm a doctor. I can suffer through pain, right? Like I should be able to push through. And also I'm so worried about prioritizing me, about thinking about, you know, what I need, because I'm appropriately worried about the baby. And in many of these situations, actually, there isn't really a conflict there. So we can get people the care they need while also not having any negative impacts. But when we don't share those things, then we can rapidly get to a situation which is much worse, where we need even more supportive care. So I really feel like people should talk more about this. And I guess the other thing I will say is that in many of the least researched parts of complicated pregnancy are things where the outcome that we would care about is about your experience. Right? Is it something that isn't maybe life-threatening, but really affects your quality of life? And because we don't talk about them, perhaps, and because of other things about not caring so much about the experiences of women in many cases, we end up not having that be something we focus on. So something like uterine prolapse. You know, you can have prolapse, and that can result in your uterus or other organs effectively being out of your vagina. So people can actually have a situation in which it's very uncomfortable to walk, to have sex, to do all kinds of things because there's a bulge in your vagina. That's not life-threatening, but it's not good. And if we don't talk about it because we're ashamed or we think, oh, I don't want to be a person who complains, then nobody cares about that and studies it and puts it on the left-hand side of their regression. And then we don't have funding. And so some of this book and some of what I'm hoping to do with the community discussions around this are really getting people to say, you know, hey, this happened to me and it happened to a lot of other people. Oh my goodness, we should be doing more.
Mm-hmm. That absolutely makes sense to me. And it is so true, Emily. I have to say, with the uterine prolapse, there's been so many more conversations of late where women are like, I just learned about this today.
Yeah.
Which is incredible.
Right.
Right? It's like people are walking through decades of life with no knowledge because there's this incredible silence around something that is deemed to be taboo when in fact it happens.
It happens. Yeah. And if you said, you know, I have a knee problem, you know, my kneecap is out. No, you might be like, oh, I'm so embarrassed to discuss like the myth. People will be like, look, let me show you what happened to my knee. And yet this, it's not something we should be ashamed of, but it absolutely, I mean, absolutely is in that kind of shame.
Mm-hmm. So in your most recent book, The Unexpected, you cover a number of complications. And as you know, I navigated preterm labor and then subsequent pregnancy loss. So in your experience, how can we use the data to support navigating subsequent pregnancies after experiences that are similar to what I had?
I think the first step in a lot of that is to try to understand what happened as close as possible to the events that happened. And that's actually quite hard. I mean, I think you talked a little bit about this at the top, but like to sort of engage with something that's very, very tough in the moment right after it happens, really, really hard. It's also, if you can do it, incredibly valuable, because that's the point at which you will remember the most about what happened, your doctor will remember the most about what happened, and collecting all of that information in that moment, even if you're not going to use it right away, can really inform, you know, going forward to the next experience, because some of the causes of something like your preterm birth are things, you know, doctors will be able to think about, okay, how can we intervene to prevent that from happening again? So I think there's some work there. And then there's, I think, a lot of work with your doctor when you decide to try for another one to say, you know, are there things we should do differently in preparation? Are there things we should do differently at the beginning? Are there things like, what is the plan for how we're going to engage with this next experience so we can have as the best chance of a different outcome this next time? And sometimes that means changing providers or getting help from a provider who is, who Nate and I talk some in the book about the decision of, you know, after a complicated pregnancy, should you get a maternal fetal medicine specialist or should you consult with one? There are different specialties. So there's some choice there, but it's really this, you know, trying to engage at the moment of when it's happened and then trying to engage at the beginning of another attempt.
Emily, so many things. I wish I had had this book when I was going through all of this, and just kind of picking up on that theme about, you know, what to expect or kind of how to plan or think about navigating subsequent pregnancies. Many people, and I know you kind of touch on this in the book as well, you might have had an uneventful, kind of some might even in recall bias say blissful first pregnancy, but then they encounter secondary infertility or have to, you know, don't necessarily think, well, if I had a quote easy first pregnancy, my second, my third, my fourth subsequent ones should be easy. We know from your data, we know that that's not necessarily the case. And we also know that there's a lot of provider variation to the point you're making about how to think about providers. Just can you offer us some of what you've learned and what you and Nate describe? And even if you had an uneventful first pregnancy, what should we do, even thinking about family planning, et cetera, for subsequent pregnancies?
So it's worth putting a pin in the secondary infertility point, because actually secondary infertility is about as common as primary infertility. So I think many people are very surprised to find that, and that, you know, the idea that I got pregnant the first time, so it should just like kind of work like that the second time. So secondary infertility is often both a surprise, and then it's an example of something where the feedback people will get from the outside, I think, is often not respecting how complicated that is. So, you know, people, well, you already have one kid, like what, you know, not exactly why are you complaining, but like, this isn't such a big deal. And I actually think that comes up in some of these secondary pregnancy complications or pregnancy loss or, you know, other things. It's like, well, everything worked out fine. Everything's kind of good for you. So why are you so sad about this? Which is not a reasonable response, but when people come into a second pregnancy, I always think it is useful, I mean, to any pregnancy, but it's useful to think about the question of, you know, what will happen if there are complications, and at least surfacing that with your provider, especially for things where the complication could impact the existing family that you have. So things like hyperemesis or preterm birth or something where it would take you away from your ability to care for a younger child, I think that's an important thing to have a conversation with your partner about. And we talk about this a little bit in the context of hyperemesis, because one of the things women will often say is like, I didn't think about the fact that when I had hyperemesis the first time, at least I could live in the bathroom and or at the hospital. And now I have a 2-year-old. And, you know, we hadn't thought at all about how we were going to scaffold that. And so there's an aspect of planning there, which sometimes is more necessary. The second one.
I mean, Emily, hearing you, this sounds just so straightforward and logical. Yet as a person who's been through multiple pregnancies, I can tell you that these were not the conversations that were had. We weren't talking about this when I was doing my baby CPR classes. We weren't talking about this. Even when I went in for, you know, my second and third pregnancies, I am shocked to say that this is like new for me. And that was really my experience when I was reading the book, like, huh, for all the research that I'm done, this is still new. And I'm sure that listeners are having that same experience.
I think we want so badly for things to go well. And that instinct is so good in some ways. And what's hard here is living with the hope that it will go well, but the preparation for if it doesn't. And, you know, holding both of those things at the same time when this is such an emotionally fraught space is really, really hard. And so some of what we're saying in the book is almost like when you go into the doctor, like turn off the emotional part, bring someone else, bring your least emotional, you know, partner or your friend or somebody who can help you have those like non-emotional planning conversations while holding the fact that like this is really hard and you're hoping it will be different and you're sad about maybe something that happened before. And so just having all that together while like engaging in careful decision making is just an unbelievably large challenge.
So Emily, are there any last areas that you'd like to highlight or share with listeners before we close?
So I think the one thing I would say is at the top of the book, we talk about kind of some questions that you might, like a sort of series of questions you might start with your doctor if you're coming into it to trying for a second pregnancy after some kind of complication. And one of them is, why did this happen to me? I think that's a really important question because that question, when you just ask it, it's easy to hear as, why was I punished in this way? Why did this bad thing happen to me? What was my fault? What did I do? And actually, the point of this book is largely to say, we should ask that question in a way that's going to help us move forward. So it's not, why did it happen to me? You know, like, why was it my fault way? But it's, were there things about my pregnancy or my health or the circumstances I was in that made me more likely to be a person who had this? And then can we talk about whether those are things we could modify? So the ability to ask that question without bringing fault or blame to it, to ask it in a way that'll move us to decisions, that encompasses for me a lot of what we're trying to do in this book, is to use the things that happened to us, as hard as they were, to make things better the next time.
Emily Oster is an economist, professor, author, and mom. Her latest book is called The Unexpected: Navigating Pregnancy During and After Complications. Emily, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's our show this week. Well Now is produced by Vic Whitley Berry. Ben Richmond is Slate's Senior Director of Podcast Operations. Alicia Montgomery is Vice President of Audio.
We'd love to hear from you. Email us at wellnow@slate.com. And if you want to support our show, please consider becoming a Slate Plus member. You'll get to listen to this show and all of Slate's podcasts ad-free and receive bonus material from other shows like Slow Burn and Amicus. You'll also get access to all articles on the Slate site. And be sure to tune in next Wednesday as we tackle another part of the wellness industry. I'm Maya Feller.
And I'm Kavita Patel. Thanks for listening.
Spring is the best time to start a new workout routine. It's our yearly collective warm-up. Peloton accommodates you with a variety of classes and lengths to choose from. Even if you only have 5 minutes, Peloton has classes for you from guided hikes, Pilates, to HIIT rides. Peloton has everything you need to get you where you're going. Whether you prefer to run outdoors, row or ride at home, or strength train at the gym, Peloton has something for you. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.